Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and my co-host Tim Henney is out this week. Today in the program, I'll speak with Dr. Craig Bryan. He's a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Utah. He specializes in the areas of depression and suicide, very current topics this week in the aftermath of the tragic loss of one of the nation's most beloved, Robin Williams. Then a conversation with Chris Nowinski. He's the author of Head Games and has shaped his whole career around bringing awareness about concussion to athletes, coaches, and parents. We actually spoke with him in May. We'll rebroadcast that interview as we're heading into school and football season, among other sports going on. Football comes to mind most quickly. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City. Only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Kevin Stocking, president of Heber Valley Bank. We offer a full spectrum of loans for lots, construction, HELOCs, commercial, and personal needs. Our loan decisions are made locally. Heber Valley Bank is a proud supporter of KPCW. We are located in Heber City and Midway and at Grand Valley Bank in Park City. HeberValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Executive Chef Chris Sheehan from Park Meadows Country Club here, supporting KPCW. We offer regionally inspired cuisine such as pine nut crusted filet of sole for dining inside or outside. Our dining venues are also ready for any occasion, and golf, social, and dining memberships are also available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Vinto is a proud sponsor of KPCW. Vinto offers wood-fired pizza and seasonal Italian cooking for lunch and dinner. Nestled at the bottom of Lower Main Street, Vinto is open year-round and now offers a summer menu with new seasonal appetizers, salads, sandwiches, pasta, pizza, and cocktails. More at vinto.com or 615-9990.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My co-host Tim Henney is out this week. We'll call it on assignment. We're having some difficulty getting our first guest, Dr. Craig Bryan, professor of clinical psychology at the University of Utah. He is not picking up, so we hope to get him in just a few minutes. We'll go ahead and start a rebroadcast of an interview we did in May. The more we know about concussion, the more we realize we don't know, but thanks to the relentless efforts of many, but specifically our next guest, concussion has been exposed as one of the most serious injuries that face all of us, but mostly our youth, who are involved in many sports that leave them vulnerable to concussion. Christopher Nowinski is the author of Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis. Nowinski was a Harvard football player who went into the worldwide wrestling entertainment world, but began to question concussion and its long-lasting effects. His book, Head Games, was made into a documentary. It aired locally here in Park City about a year ago. He joined us by phone to talk about what he's learned since his book was released and what the current questions are regarding concussion. Chris Nowinski, welcome to The Mountain Life. Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, the more we know about concussion, the more we realize we don't know and haven't known over decades. But thanks to the relentless efforts of many, and specifically our next guest, concussion has been exposed as a public health crisis. It faces us all, but mostly here in Park City, our youth who are involved in many sports that leave them vulnerable to concussion. Chris Nowinski is the author of the book Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis. Nowinski was a Harvard football player who went into worldwide wrestling entertainment, WWE, right? And he began to question concussion and its long-lasting effects after his own injury. His book, Head Games, was made into a documentary. It aired locally about a year ago. He's joining us by phone to talk about what he's learned since then and what the current questions are and answers regarding concussion. Chris Nowinski, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
It's wonderful to have you. We saw your movie about a year ago here locally. It was brought to town, I believe, by Think Head First, which is a local organization, doctors that's all they do is concussion. We have that much of it in this community, you know, head of the base for the U.S. ski team and the many winter sports that we do here. So it is a huge question. And maybe we'll just start with a little bit of your background. We know you played football and went into wrestling, and then you had an injury, and that's when you started to ask questions.
Yeah, I'd never been diagnosed with a concussion in my first 18 years of contact sports, which included 8 years of soccer and 8 years of football, and then wrestling. And it wasn't until I had a blackout experience in the ring in a wrestling match that I forgot the rest of what we were doing out there that I had the experience. When I got backstage, I was kind of together, but I had a headache that just wouldn't go away. And for the first time, you know, like days later, that headache was still there. That fogginess was still there. And so I unfortunately didn't understand what was wrong with me. And so I lied about the injury. I didn't bring it up. And after 5 weeks of continuing to bang my head and exercise, I had to stop when I developed sleepwalking, and I had done so much damage by that point that I had to hang it up, and it led to 5 years of post-concussion syndrome, which gave me a lot of time to reflect on what I was, you know, what had happened to me and what I could do about it.
So now, Chris, with everything that you have learned and all the research and all the scientists that you have surrounded yourself with, I'm wondering, is the recovery from concussion, you know, one of the most important things? Obviously, you didn't give yourself time for recovery. If you don't do that and you get even if you hit your head just a little bit, is that when the real trouble begins?
Well, that's what the theory points to. We don't have amazing research on humans to say if you rest your brain, you'll be fine. If you don't, you won't. But all the evidence we have using animal models and other ways to look at it teaches us that, you know, one concussion in isolation, probably not a big deal. But one concussion followed by continued stress on injured tissue or multiple concussions in a row, and you may start opening the door to some very serious problems, including long-term degeneration.
Mm.
Hey, Chris, something that strikes me about this whole thing is here you are, you go through your own personal experience, and you expose this issue. At least this is how it appears to me, and maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe this issue has been around and it just wasn't getting the notoriety. But whether it was you brought notoriety to it or whether you exposed it, it's kind of related. How can that happen? And it reminds me of Al Franken, you know, doing his whole political thing and saying, I'm a comedian. If I can understand this stuff and if I can bring these issues to light, it's not that tough. And here you are, an ex-football player, an ex-wrestler, an ex-soccer player, and you're going, I had this personal experience. Where has the medical community been on this issue, and why wasn't it exposed decades ago?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. We were thinking about it yesterday as we were doing a training for some football coaches, and I started showing them quotes from the 1937 American Football Coaches Association meetings, from the 1968 NCAA Safeguards Committee, where they're all saying, when you have concussions, you cannot put athletes back into the game. It's really dangerous. Even in 1905, if you look at the diary of the Harvard football coach, he talks about letting the team doctor give a speech before every season saying, guys, if you have somebody who hits their head and they don't remember what's happening out there, call timeout and have me immediately come onto the field. That was the rule in 1905. And every time I love to ask my audiences when I speak, was anyone ever told this or ever asked to call timeout for because you thought someone had a concussion? And the answer is no. So the funny thing is, there were a lot of people who, this was actually probably well known 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and we kind of forgot about it. And luckily, there was enough research when I was hurt in 2006, enough people had been doing work on this, that I could actually just put their research together and just be a loud voice who wouldn't back down. I mean, that was kind of the argument we, you know, had to use the New York, you know, work closely with the New York Times to spread this. But we just said, look, I'm just a guy, and I can the evidence is black and white. Like, why are we lying about this? Why aren't we telling people about this?
And are you surprised by that? Are you surprised that just a guy was able to compile information and then be tenacious about not backing down and expose this issue to the degree that it has, you know, become a frontline issue?
Yeah, you know, and I guess at the beginning, yes, I was surprised. I mean, I even remember one of my football coaches telling me, hey, Chris, there, you know, early in the game, he's like, aren't there doctors who look at this stuff? And if there was a problem, wouldn't they be saying so?
Well, that's where I'm coming from.
I don't think so. Yeah. No, that's what you think. But actually, if I've done other research looking at other kind of public health issues and where they came from. And it's kind of funny that this, you know, people just kind of, you know, you can be blinded by the status quo and never really dig into things. You might need to have a personal experience to understand it. One of the interesting ones is if you look at smoking and lung cancer, the first person to ever make that connection and really start making a stink about it was a graduate student. Wasn't even a medical doctor yet, who looked at a series of autopsies and said, hey, oh, the smokers are getting this lung cancer, the non-smokers are not. What gives? End up writing a book about it. He was one of the guys that really brought awareness to that. So it sometimes just takes somebody, you know, because it's not easy work. You know, there was a lot of fights over the years. So sometimes you just have to want to go through the uncomfortable conversations because you believe in it so much and you can break through.
That's right. Well, sorry, during the scope of the movie, and I didn't read your book, but I did see the movie, it seems as though the gravity of concussion and the seriousness of the situation was for a long time sort of shrouded and kept cloaked by the NFL. But during the time that you started uncovering this, there was a little bit of a shift. Talk about that shift and why you think it was kept so secret, really, in the beginning.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to kind of look at this from a financial perspective. You know, once money became such a big part of sports, there were a couple issues. One, you know, if you could have players play through concussion, your team might be more successful. And also, you didn't want to pay for the long-term damage that you were doing to people. And so, as a policy, if you could minimize the effects of concussions, you'd probably want to. And that's what the NFL did, but they went dramatically too far by also publishing really bad research, trying to convince people that, you know, kids are safe too, and everybody's safe. Mm-hmm. So the shift really happened over many years. I mean, the first brain that I, you know, and a lot of it was came from the studying the brains of athletes when they passed away. I mean, that was really kind of the difference maker, because concussions are largely an invisible injury. And so it's been hard to make a case that concussions are so bad, because almost everybody who gets them seems fine days, weeks, months later. And so what's the big deal? And you don't get their life track to appreciate what happened 30, 40 years later. But by studying the brains post-mortem, starting with Andre Waters and now 200 athletes later, we can show the very devastating pictures of what this disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, looks like. And it just basically became a game of one brain, they blew it off. Two brains, they blew it off. Three brains, now the media is getting involved. Four brains, now there's something going on. 10 brains, and suddenly, you know, Congress is involved. And so it really became a game of increasing the evidence and increasing the pressure through the media to force change that we knew needed to happen.
Can you define chronic brain encephalopathy? Is it just the effects, the long-term effects, or the permanent effects of concussion?
No, chronic traumatic encephalopathy is actually a degenerative brain disease that all the evidence point to is caused by trauma. So it's the idea that some level of hit, so it's either a hard hit or we think maybe multiple hits in a short period of time, can spark a degenerative process in a tiny part of your brain that will continue to spread for the rest of your life in an Alzheimer's-type pathway. And eventually, once it takes enough tissue, once it's killed enough cells, you start to have symptoms. And once it's, you know, and beyond that, you can eventually get dementia from the disease.
And Chris, the 200 brains that you've looked at and taken your data from, I mean, initially you might assume that they were all from one or two sports and primarily football, but this is contact sport is a much broader umbrella. Can you kind of walk us through the various sports and the level of risk that people are being exposed to in those different sports?
Sure. You know, the initial research was done in boxing. You know, that's why we called it punch drunk. Football came next, but in between football, which was the first case was published in 2005, there were other brains that were studied around the world. And it wasn't even just athletes. By 2007, there was a soccer player in the literature, someone who had epilepsy and had 100 falls from seizures where they were hit their head, two people with developmental disabilities who engaged in headbanging behavior, a circus clown who shot out of a cannon too much, and a victim of abuse. And since then, now we've added football at every level, college, high school, pro. You know, we're 58 out of 62 professional football players that we've studied have had the disease. Ice hockey, just recently, we added soccer, rugby, baseball. I mean, basically, wherever you're exposed to a lot of concussions, we're going to find it if we get those brains to look at.
So let's talk about what goes on at Boston University. It's my understanding that that's where they first started looking at brains at post-mortem brains and discovering literally by taking cross sections of a brain and looking. Is that where the bigger part of the research is still going on?
That's the kind of one of our core research programs. So the way it started is my treating physician, who happened to be one of the world's experts on this, Dr. Robert Cantu, and I started the Sports Legacy Institute in 2007 when we started getting some brains. And then we went to try to find top researchers to work with to study those brains, and that was Boston University. So we partnered together along with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, because we actually have the brain bank at a VA center. And it started with the brain bank work, because that really told, the ultimate goal of all this is obviously to understand risk factors for it so we can prevent it and understand how to treat it. But that we needed to start with a common resource, because there was no center in the world dedicated to CTE research before we started one in 2008. So we needed to just build that brain bank to start understanding what the disease was that we were facing so we could identify ways to diagnose it in living people and to eventually treat it.
Okay.
And so now we have a clinical research program. We have 100 NFL players that we follow longitudinally. We have a phone registry where we get information on 800 people annually. We have a basic sciences program where we've learned how to create CTE in a mouse model using blast injury. So it's a really growing group of experts that are getting their arms wrapped around this.
I want to ask you a few questions. I'll just throw these questions at you, and you can let me know if there are any solid answers there's any scientific evidence that says one way or another that whether certain heads are more susceptible to concussion, whether you ever fully recover from concussion, and once you have had concussion, if you remain more vulnerable to the next concussion.
Sure. In terms of if you're, certain people are more at risk, empirically, yes. But we don't really know why. We pretty much know that every disease or injury has risk factors to it, and many of them are genetic, many are environmental. But there hasn't been enough work to really tease that out. What were the other two questions?
That's right. I'm just testing you to see, what your post-concussion syndrome is. And then once you get a concussion, are you able to ever fully recover?
Functionally, yes. So it's the idea that most people with one concussion will get back to themselves, but not everybody does. We don't really know what percentage that is. It's somewhere between, 1 and maybe 10 that have long-term changes. Everybody who has concussion, we often talk about it as, if your brain's a computer, we talk about it as a software issue. Your brain's rebooting. But the more we know, basically everybody suffers some sort of physical brain injury, and that's not going to necessarily heal itself. So your brain probably changes and for the negative, but most people on tests will turn out to be just the same. But long term, something's different.
So what they've seen with the postmortem brains is that once you even get one slight concussion, there remains some sort of lesion or something on the brain, right?
Right. We do see white matter injury in just about everybody who we've got in the brain within a couple days or a couple weeks of a concussion. So you do have diffuse axonal injury. It's very, very small. It's microscopic. It's hard to find, and you can't see it on scans. So that's why we assume people are fine.
Okay. And then the third question was whether or not once you get a concussion, you're more susceptible. You know, you just get a light head knock and you've got another concussion.
Again, the evidence is yes, you do get more susceptible. It's not great evidence. Epidemiological evidence is, some studies say you're 2 to 4 times more likely to have more concussions. But part of that also is the fact that you now understand what a concussion is, so you're more likely to report future concussions once you've been diagnosed with one, because most people ignore them when they get them. But there's also, when I was training these coaches, in fact, of the 4 high schools that we had, 2 of their head coaches were both post-concussed still to this day. One said, every time I get tapped in the head, and they're both players through college. One said, every time I get tapped in the head, I get a concussion. And the other one said he still has headaches from the concussions he had in college.
Wow.
And these guys were, not young. So, there's definitely something to that.
So, Chris, now that you've started the center in 2008 and you've been compiling this data, it seems like an awful lot of progress has been made in making this a public issue and bringing awareness over that short period of time. But I guess my question is, are we still at the tip of the iceberg of this issue, or have we drilled down to, some sort of depth of understanding? Or do you think over the next 10 years, we're just going to be totally shocked by what we learn by the additional information that you're gathering?
I think we're at the tip of the iceberg on research. I mean, the more we dig, the more we're just seeing, shocking things. I mean, the study came out yesterday. And I forget the university, but it was 25 college players who were concussed in the last year, 25 college football players who didn't have concussions, and then 25 normal people. And the hippocampus of the players who were concussed was like 20% smaller than normal people, which is just like a shocking finding. I mean, 20% is huge. I think we're uncovering more and more concerning things about brain injury and their long-term consequences. In terms of how safe our kids are, we're dramatically safer now. If you think about it, we have 50 state laws that say you can no longer put a kid back into the game when they have a concussion. And in most states, we're training coaches, and in some states, we're training athletes. But the reality is we have so much farther we can go to make athletes safer that, still wouldn't even change the games. And then we do need to have some serious discussions about changing the games. If you're talking about, age differences are huge, so we're talking about getting rid of heading in soccer before you're in high school, tackle football being maybe a bad idea before you're in high school. And then, you look at what you guys are dealing with in terms of winter sports and action sports, you have to be plain to say what we're seeing in like snowboarding and the tricks that people are doing. We're getting to insane places where none of these kids are going to, you really worry about the long-term consequences from all these falls.
Well, Chris, I wanted to ask you, you sort of segued into it. I was going to ask you to project out maybe 20 years from now with additional data and research and what we're learning, and we're at the tip of the iceberg, and the change that could conceivably occur to the game or various contact sport games. It seems like football could theoretically go away because you can't play football without banging your head every now and then. And I know you're talking about protecting kids and it's much safer for kids, but it raises the question in my mind, if we're just not having contact football while you're a child, what makes it okay to do when you're not a child, when you're an adolescent, or when you're a young person, or when you're a professional? I mean, why does it all of a sudden go from super dangerous for our children to okay now? I mean, that...
Yeah, well, I mean, you're getting into more, cultural questions than medical questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you can see it from a lot of different angles. Like, part of the reason we say it's more dangerous to, play football as a child are things like, you know, there's data saying if you have an athletic trainer, you're more likely to have your concussions diagnosed, and we don't provide them for anyone before high school. So you'll never diagnose a child's concussion. Your chances are just much, much, much smaller. The whole idea of hitting a child in the head before they're even old enough to recognize when they might be concussed and then can report it to you, we assume that might start in the teenage years, but we're not sure. So on the one side, you can easily say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be encouraging kids to get hit in the head hundreds of thousands of times in any sport. Like, what's the point? Just change the sport. And on the other side, you have the people who say, well, there's risk in everything. And what, you know, can we control that risk? And so, it's more of an ethical, it depends on what your ethics are and what you know about brain trauma.
Well, you've hit on it. It's that cultural change. And we have these, you know, cultural phenomenons where we think it's okay to be a boxer, you know, and the first one you used was that punch drunk. Well, I mean, you could make a pretty strong argument that, you know, nobody should be boxing, but yet fighting occurs and is going to continue, and we've made it a sport and it's part of the culture. But it brings me back to the mothers of kids when I was growing up, you know, and football was a big thing and nobody worried or talked about concussion and a lot of other things that shock me now. But you know, there was always that kid who wasn't allowed to play football by his mom. And wow, it's like there's the beginning of that cultural shift. And what you're doing with your medical research is bringing awareness, and you've pushed that shift. I mean, it is shifting. There is something happening here, and it's a cultural phenomenon. And I think it's great that you're doing it. But do you see that going so far that we actually are not allowing certain sports to take place?
You know, I think from a policy perspective, it's very unlikely that anybody has the ability to ban any sport. So it'll basically come down to a lot of individual choices. Those moms. And part of our role is to provide every parent with the best evidence that we have so they can understand the risks of the sport they choose to engage their child in.
Well, I'll tell you, from a personal example, again, my son played lacrosse, which is a contact sport, football, contact sport. I would not let that happen now. And that was 8 years ago. So that's a big shift in a short period of time from an ex-football player.
Yeah.
In high school.
Right. Well, we've learned a lot more. I mean, you can't ignore these brains and the horror stories. I mean, we're just talking about the science of it, but talk to their families about the horror stories of being raised by a man with chronic traumatic encephalopathy who has impulse control problems, aggressiveness issues, mm-hmm. memory problems. I mean, it's rough.
Chris, may I ask you if you have kids?
I do not. I did just get married in November. Somebody was willing to accept the risks in my future. But I'll have to deal with that soon, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay. So when you do deal with that, will you let your kids play contact sports?
So the way I look at it right now is I can't imagine enrolling my child in a sport, at least certainly prior to high school, where brain trauma is not accidental and rare. Right, kids will collide, I get that, and that's fine, but the idea of repetition to me is not a good idea. I think hopefully the science will be better to know about what to do once they start getting to physical maturity and what the real risks are. But, you know, I played basketball this morning, and I still play three times a week. I mean, that might be the sport I'm trying to steer my kids into.
Right. Okay. Well, let us know where we can find what you're doing currently and where all of this research is going.
So I would recommend going to the website of our nonprofit. That's the Sports Legacy Institute. There you can grab, information. You can learn about, if you're a parent, go to our concussion checklist site. There's links from there where you can assess how safe your child's program is and learn ways to make it safer. You can pick up a copy of the book. You can pick up a copy of the documentary. This is something where parents really need to engage the material and make some hard decisions because, you know, their kids only have one brain and you got to protect it the best you can.
That's right. Well, Chris Nowinski is the author of Head Games. It was made into a documentary. Many of us around here saw that last year, and it is fascinating and engaging, and we're very happy that you could join us today. So thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Good talking to you.
Bye-bye. Again, that was Chris Nowinski, author of Head Games, and that was a rebroadcast interview from May. Still, of course, very current as we head into sporting season among our youth here in Park City. Stay tuned. I'll be back with Dr. Craig Bryan. Specializes in depression and suicide. He's a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Utah. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My co-host Tim Henney is out today. Well, depression and suicide are forefront on everyone's mind this week following the tragic suicide of one of America's most beloved, Robin Williams. My next guest is Dr. Craig Bryan. He's a professor at the University of Utah of Clinical Psychology. He specializes in the areas of depression and suicide and also in the mental health of veterans. He's joining me now by phone. Good morning to you, Dr. Bryan.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us today. And of course, I know you've probably talked a lot on this topic this week, but we're all thinking about suicide and depression, foremost depression and how debilitating it is. And maybe you could just start by, outlining just what depression is, what happens in our brains.
Yeah, so the way that we typically categorize depression and define it is the primary symptom is some sort of mood disturbance. And there can actually be two different types of mood disturbance. The one that most of us think about is sort of feeling sad, you know, where our mood goes down. We might associate that with crying spells or that notion of feeling depressed. The other type of mood disturbance is an inability to experience positive emotions, so being unable to feel happy or unable to feel excited or joy in life. And so the second type of mood disturbance, that inability to experience positive emotions, is actually really common, and I think that is one aspect of depression that many people are not aware of and they often miss as a result. Now, other symptoms that go along with depression are things like insomnia, whether that's sleeping too much or not sleeping enough, changes in appetite, changes in concentration and memory functioning. And then, of course, sometimes we see thoughts of death, wishing that one was no longer alive, and even thoughts of suicide.
And, you know, suicide, and I don't mean to launch right into it, but I guess, you know, what remains always the question for me is suicide sort of a crime of passion or an episodic event that if they could just get through it, they would no longer have thoughts of suicide? You know, does it come up very quickly and it's just done? It's not premeditated?
Yeah, so what we're starting to understand now about suicide is that sort of traditional way of understanding suicide is, yes, that sort of impulsive, it comes out of the blue, a stressor happens, and the person acts without much forethought. And to outsiders, that's often how it seems. So to family members and friends, oftentimes it does seem like it kind of came out of nowhere. And in our work with suicidal individuals, even sometimes to the suicidal person, it seems like it just sort of came out of nowhere or happened impulsively. But what we're understanding now in a lot of our research is maybe that's not as accurate as we thought. And a lot of suicidal individuals, you know, have histories where they've thought about it, whereas you mentioned it's more episodic, where they go through in and out different suicidal crises, and over time, when a new stressor occurs, it's almost sort of like they've reflected upon this option in the past, and so they're able to reach back and think of a way to kill themselves without much effort. Oftentimes because they've thought about it before and they've either kind of gotten through the crisis, they were able to successfully cope with it, etc. So we are starting to now evolve and understand that, you know, this really isn't quite as impulsive traditional way that we have talked about it.
I think when we hear of suicide, you know, for those of us who, you know, who would just never end up in that situation, you know, we say things like, well, I'd be too scared to pull a trigger or to jump off a building or to hang myself. And that, again, there must be something in the minds of those who end up doing it that's just so off.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are starting to realize that suicidal individuals do think differently and that they have different ways of solving problems. They have different ways of thinking about short-term versus long-term consequences, and it goes beyond depression. So a lot of us typically think of depression as the primary risk factor for suicide, but we know that suicide cuts across many, many different types of psychiatric conditions and psychological injuries, and that sort of psychiatric approach isn't, you know, specific enough. You know, just thinking of this as an outcome of depression actually isn't very helpful, because 95% of people with depression do not die by suicide. And so some of the research that we're doing, for instance, is starting to uncover that suicidal individuals have very specific thought processes. They view themselves as oftentimes defective or broken, as if I don't deserve to live, I deserve punishment, I can't tolerate this pain, this is unbearable. And these types of thought processes, interestingly, seem to be pretty specific to the suicidal state. And these advances in our research has actually sort of been a primary driver for some of the new treatments and interventions that we're now using. And we now know that actually very specific types of psychotherapies that target these suicidal beliefs actually reduce suicide attempts by 50% or more. So we're getting better and better at treating and reducing the risk for suicide attempts.
Wow. So when you first said treatments, I was thinking medication, but then you said psychotherapy. And so what would they be doing in a session that would reduce it that to that degree? It's really quite something.
Yeah, so what the evidence seems to suggest now, based on a large number of research studies, is that medication by itself doesn't seem to have much of an effect on suicide attempts, but medication combined with certain forms of psychotherapy does actually seem to have a significant and pronounced effect. And what we typically do in these therapies is we focus on the thoughts and the actions and the decisions that the person makes. And so a lot of it is actually, we kind of refer to it as skills training. So the patient will come in, and oftentimes they report things like, I just don't know how to solve problems. I don't know what to do when I'm in a crisis and I feel trapped or backed into a corner. And what we do then is we teach them basic strategies like relaxation, meditation, how to remember what's worth living for, and then we get into targeting those beliefs that they have. So shame, we try to undermine shame and guilt in the sense that people would be better off without me. And we do this over and over again, usually over the course of 12 sessions. And what we have found is at the end of the therapy, our patients, in essence, know what to do now. They find that suicide, although we can't eliminate that as an option, it's an option that's way at the bottom of the list. It's just they never have to really kind of get that far down the problem-solving list, because something else that we've taught them works.
Very interesting. Are there precursors to those suicidal thoughts? You know, because you mentioned sentiments like I don't deserve, and, you know, all those are there precursors like, you know, extreme guilt and shame and things like that, that people can be on the lookout for even if they never get to that stage?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're finding now that guilt in particular is actually a better predictor, a stronger risk factor than depression. And so this is feeling bad about the things that I've done. You know, I've made mistakes, and so, and I don't deserve to be forgiven for these mistakes. Now, what's interesting is when we work with suicidal individuals, they often feel like they've made mistakes and don't deserve, you know, forgiveness. Now, of course, to us on the outside, we don't perceive those as mistakes, you know, and we have a very different perception about the judgment that the suicidal person applies to themselves. And so that's definitely one of the newer warning signs that we're really focusing on. We're also noticing that agitation is really important. So people who kind of feel restless, on edge, can't sleep, they tend to be at increased risk for suicide as well.
Wow. And do these surface at different times throughout our lives? I mean, can they be related to hormones even, you know, that increased agitation, the depression? I know, you know, I've read when women go through menopause, for example, they will have this episodic, you know, depression or even suicidal thoughts. Right. It all has to do with hormones.
Right, exactly. So there is absolutely a physiological aspect to this. This is why, you know, most of the patients that I treat do take medication at the same time, because it's helping to, I always say, kind of turn the volume down or help to manage some of that anxiety and that agitation, which then helps to calm them down a little bit. And so we've often used with some suicidal patients as well who are having lots of sleep problems, we focus on insomnia very early on, which might mean, you know, a very short-term prescription of sleep medication just to kind of reset their bodies, so to speak. And so, yes, so physiological hormonal aspects of just the natural development process can contribute, and those are the types of things that we take into account in treatment, so that it's sort of a multimodal approach, and we're hitting all of these different contributors trying to deactivate what we call the suicidal mode.
And, you know, talking about those hormones makes me think, and I don't know if you treat adolescents or teens, but, you know, teen suicide being on the rise, you know, the interplay of hormones with teen suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what we're finding is, again, developmentally, there's some interesting research that has been conducted as well, where if you track cohorts of individuals from, you know, childhood up into adulthood, what we see is that suicidal ideation is often experienced by more people than what we would anticipate. So, for instance, there was a study published a few years ago that found over the course of 20 years, this cohort of boys, they started studying boys, over 50% reported suicidal thoughts at some point during that 20-year span. And what's interesting is that in retrospect, if as adults, when they asked many of these boys, hey, have you ever in your life in the past thought about suicide? You know, many said, no, I had not, even though 15 years ago they had said yes. And what we think it is just that because there might be certain times, particularly during adolescence, where as a person is developing, they're experiencing a lot of change in mood, in their worldview, their identity. We know now that developmentally there are changes in the sleep cycle that occur during adolescence, and so suicidal thoughts might be experienced, but then, again, they resolve. The person gets on with their life, and then as an adult, they look back on it, and they've either forgotten about it, or they have just a different perspective on life and say, well, you know, maybe that thing that was a crisis as a teenager, you know, now that I'm older, maybe it doesn't really seem like a crisis anymore. And so we sort of reevaluate our life experiences.
I want to ask you also, and by the way, my guest is Dr. Craig Bryan, professor of clinical psychology at the University of Utah. And of course, in the case of Robin Williams, addiction played into it hugely. And I don't know how much you work with addiction, but there seemed to be, you know, very interesting with two recent celebrity deaths, Philip Seymour Hoffman and now Robin Williams. You know, they both suffered from depression. One and addiction, you know, one ends up dying with a heroin overdose, the other one ends up dying by hanging himself. You know, just talk a little bit, if you would, about addiction and how it plays into it.
Yeah, so substance abuse is very common amongst individuals with psychiatric conditions. And so our work with suicide, you know, at least 25% of the patients we work with have some form of substance use disorder. And the way that we have kind of understood this is that many times individuals use substances in order to obtain a desired psychological state. So for many people, particularly those, for instance, with depression, because they're suffering, they might drink alcohol or use opiates or heroin, et cetera, to help numb or avoid that psychological pain. Others might use stimulants such as cocaine to get or achieve a positive emotional state. And so when we look at sort of the underlying reasons that many people find themselves using substances, those motivations are actually the same as suicide. So suicide is oftentimes an attempt to escape internal psychological pain that seems like it's never going to get better, that seems overwhelming. And so these two behaviors, substance use and suicide attempts, often go hand in hand together because they're sort of motivated by that same desire to alleviate suffering.
Does substance abuse and addiction further delay our healing because we're not recognizing truly what we should emotionally? We're just delaying it or dampering it.
It can. And again, this is where what we're learning about some of the treatments, if you use very specific treatments that directly target the underlying motivations, what we find is that in addition to reducing risk for substance use, we actually see that reduced risk for suicide attempts, almost like you can kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that has actually been an important aspect of, I think, our advances in psychotherapy in the past decade or so, is recognizing it's not the diagnosis itself, right? So whether we call it depression, we call it substance use or anxiety, we can name it whatever we want. The underlying sort of process or the things that give rise to these names are things like difficulty regulating emotions, difficulties tolerating stress. We've also seen now neurologically individuals with depression and with substance use, they have what we call attentional bias. So that means substance users pay attention to things in the environment that are associated with substance use. Mm-hmm. So if they go to a dinner party, they'll be the one who knows exactly where the wine bottle is located because there's something neurologically, they focus on those things. Depressed people focus on sort of negative outcomes and sad stimuli, et cetera. And suicidal people, we're now starting to learn, focus on things that happen in their lives that are consistent with the theme of death. And so our treatments now kind of target these underlying etiologies or causes, and that's why you can hit multiple problems with one single treatment.
You know, antidepressants have been around a very long time. I'm not sure how long, but it still seems like they really come up short, and I'm not sure why that is.
Yeah, so the reason we think that antidepressants and other medications as a solitary therapy, as the only form of treatment, don't seem to be as effective as certain types of psychotherapies is because we're now understanding that one of the core issues that gives rise to suicide risk is problem-solving skills. And so medication does help alleviate emotional distress and psychiatric symptoms. But it doesn't necessarily teach the individual how to, you know, consider alternatives to a crisis and how to solve problems or how to use brief relaxation or mindfulness activities to regulate or to manage their own distress at any given moment. And so it's these skills that we really are seeing now across multiple studies that have been conducted over the past 20 years. It's the skills that seem to actually explain the outcomes.
Craig, I'm wondering, I assume you didn't know Robin Williams personally, but I would assume that you also maybe weren't altogether too surprised to hear of his suicide. If you weren't, why is that?
I suppose I was, but I wasn't. I mean, you know, as someone who studies suicide, you know, certainly I had heard, you know, the reports last month that he had checked into drug rehabilitation again. And so, you know, in my head I'm thinking, you know, what's going on? Has he relapsed? Is he in another depressive episode, et cetera? But it's one of those interesting things about suicide where, as common as it is, it's the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and from the age of 15 to 45, it's the second or third leading cause of death. So it's a very common cause of death, yet at the same time, if we just look at sort of the proportion of people in our society who die by suicide, it's a very small percentage. And so it's this paradox where a very common cause of death at the same time is, from a statistical perspective, not very common. I find that it's surprising even in high-risk individuals, because by default, you would expect that most people would not die by suicide. And so so the news of his death, I think, you know, was surprising to me, even though I was aware of many of his risk factors.
Right. And those people who do have access to joy and laughter and humor, you would think have some better coping strategies, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those interesting things about suicide. You know, and I think mental health conditions as a whole is that, you know, how a person appears on the outside isn't always necessarily a reflection of their own inner psychological state. And so this is why I do think, if we go back to what we're talking about before, suicide can often seem like it comes out of the blue and it's unexpected, because a person's outward appearances, how they behave, aren't necessarily always a reflection of the thoughts that they're experiencing and their inner struggles.
Very interesting. Well, we're just about out of time. Dr. Craig Bryan is a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Utah. I also did just want to mention that you specialize in post-traumatic stress disorder, and you work a lot with veterans, and I think that's very interesting. I didn't have a lot of time to go into that, but what are you currently working on?
Yeah, so our primary focus right now is actually improving and developing treatments and interventions for suicidal military personnel, and that's where we've actually sent some of the treatment stuff that I was describing to you has come out of our research, where we're finding that our therapies are actually reducing suicide attempts in the military, and actually we're hoping that those results will be published soon, and we've got several news studies looking at you know, different factors that are related to suicide risk in the military.
All right. Well, Dr. Craig Bryan, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Best of luck. And again, Dr. Craig Bryan of the University of Utah. Want to thank both of our guests today, Christopher Nowinski and Craig Bryan. Also, our underwriters, Park City Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, and Vinto Pizzeria.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Tune in to Cool Science Radio tomorrow at 9 a.m. John Wells and I will be speaking with former Park City Mayor Dana Williams. Oh yeah, he's a scientist. This is KPCW Park City. Time now for news.